Hi, Blogging Ahead. I'm Dana Goldstein. I'm a freelance writer in New York, contributing to The Daily Beast, The American Prospect, The Nation, and a bunch of other magazines. And I'm here today with a Blogging Ahead's newbie. Catherine, do you want to introduce yourself?
Sure. Hey, I'm Catherine Mengue Ward. I'm a senior editor at Reason Magazine in Washington, D.C.
Great. So we're going to talk about three really interesting topics today. First off, Rand Paul and the latest, I guess, revelations about his college years. Secondly, we're going to discuss a really interesting social policy topic that touches on poverty and education and gender, which is the new study showing that girls, especially low-income minority girls, are entering puberty as young as 7 years old. And third, we're going to discuss some summer reading. So I'm really glad I have Catherine here today because I'm very curious to talk to a libertarian about the movement's relationship with Rand Paul. At this particular point in time, a lot of you have probably read the profile Rand Paul in GQ, which focused on his years at Baylor University, which is a Baptist school in Texas, in the early 1980s. And it has emerged that he was a member of sort of a secret society called NOZE, N-O-Z-E. And it was less of a secret skull and bones type thing than a kind of lampoonish group, and one of the things that really united this group of kids is that they were very derisive of Baylor's Christian sort of piety. And in particular, one of the things that Rand did, and it's called the Aqua Buddha controversy, is that he and a friend kidnapped a girl that they knew who was also on the swim team with Rand Paul. They sort of tied her up and they kind of blindfolded her, tried to get her to smoke some pot out of a bong. And then they brought her in front of some sort of stream or body of water, and they forced her to say, "I worship Aqua Buddha," which I guess would be especially controversial at Baylor University because it's a Christian school and there's a lot of, anxiety about false idols. And the woman became a psychologist. And she didn't reveal her name to the magazine or to the readers, I should say. But she's saying that after this, you know, it was a pretty traumatic experience and she didn't really ever have any contact with Rand Paul. So some feminists are pretty outraged about this. The young blogger Shelby Knox, who has a great blog, is saying that this is kind of indicative. The way the media is kind of treating this Aqua Buddha episode as a big joke is indicative of the boys will be boys culture that sort of tells young men that, say, between the ages of about 12 and 25, they're kind of allowed to get away with anything. But actually, if you kind of scratch the surface of the story that first seems funny, it's a story of a kidnapping and harassment of a young woman who would want to be sort of tied up and, pressured to use drugs. It could be a very scary experience. And so there's some outrage there. And then what I want to ask you about, Catherine, which really interests me, is sort of the issue of Rand Paul, now the Republican nominee, kind of representing the whole spectrum of the Republican Party and of the conservative movement. And in particular, how would the religious right kind of feel about this story? Because it much more seems like a libertarian thing to do, to have had a youth where you were very derisive of organized religion and sort of chafing against that.
Right. I mean, I would say a couple of things. First of all, it sort of is fantastic that one of the big news stories of August is named the Aqua Buddha story or the Aqua Buddha scandal.
When I first heard about this yesterday, I was like, what?
Yeah, and this is a perfume that I would absolutely buy, right? It's like a little sandalwood, a little chlorine, maybe a slight skunkiness to the perfume. Like
it's a perfect summer scent.
Aqua Buddha by Calvin Klein. You know, that's something that I would totally go for. as the always happy to provide token libertarian on stuff like this, I think that there's a couple things going on here. First of all is the generational element. Like, if this had happened in the 60s or 70s, I don't even think this would be a story. Like, maybe I'm just too young and I don't understand what things are like, but it seems to me that in, like, 1969, kidnapping a girl and trying to get her to smoke some weed and then saying something about Buddha happened like absolutely every Tuesday on every college campus in America. And one thing that seems weird about this story is that it happened in, I think, 1983. So it has this almost like was it just that Baylor was like behind the times and like living its like prankster, you know, merry prankster hippie days in 1983? I don't know. But I do think that these kind of stories, you know, applied to a generation of politicians who came of age in the 60s where we didn't talk about it as much. And of course, we do have George W. Bush, who was young and irresponsible when he was young and irresponsible, and in fact does have his own share of drugs and secret society related semi-scandalous stories kind of floating around about there, floating around out there. But to the sort of more serious libertarian point, I think that there is a dynamic that happens in the libertarian world or amongst people who hold libertarian views, which is that if you're a libertarian, you have to be even weirder than the typical politician to want to be in politics, right? Like, I have a kind of constitutional skepticism of someone who wants to go into electoral politics in general, and I think a lot of Americans do. You know, you do have to have a touch of the megalomania, a touch of the kind of inflated ego to want to do that. If you pair that with a political philosophy that's skeptical of the state, you have to be really a little bit of an odd duck to want to be involved in this enterprise that you think is in many ways fundamentally corrupt and corrupting. So it's not that surprising that libertarians that rise to the kind of national notice in politics are weird characters from that perspective.
Mm-hmm. But what is the Christian right, who he's asking to come out and vote for him as the Republican nominee, going to make of sort of revelations that as a young man he was just very, very derisive of organized religion?
Yeah, well, and this is something that's just totally baffling to me about the entire Paul family. Both Rand and his father Ron Paul, who obviously made a lot of headlines during the last electoral cycle, are in many ways some of the most consistent libertarians out there, but they're also God guys. They're also religious. And as soon as they try, as both of them have, to be a part of the mainstream Republican Party, you know, I think this happens naturally, you look for commonalities. And with Ron Paul, the two points of commonality were God and immigration. He was very skeptical of and hostile to many forms of immigration, particularly illegal. And so you wind up emphasizing that stuff. And my line about Ron Paul when he was kind of in the news was that I agree with him about maybe 85% of topics. Unfortunately, he's emphasizing the other 15. And I think that's,
right.
That's a problem with Rand Paul also, that, you know, if he wants to campaign as a God guy, and actually today he kind of came out along with would-be Republican candidate Gary Johnson, the former governor of New Mexico, who's maybe most famous for pushing legalization of marijuana there. Both of them today, coincidentally, there were stories about how they don't really like the word libertarian and don't want to be associated with it. And, you know, it's because they want a Republican slot. And, you know, God bless them on that. I mean, the Libertarian Party is a joke, in my view, and it is not going to make any electoral headway, so you got to try something. But I think the weird result is this thing where he's maybe kind of playing a role. I think these days he's a Presbyterian or something, kind of mainline Presbyterian, and that role might not really reflect where he's been and even what his priorities are now, but he's emphasizing it because of this weird role that God plays in our politics in the United States, particularly mm-hmm. in the Republican Party.
Yeah, and of course it's a totally Oedipal story too, because Ron Paul has described himself as Baptist, and then he went ahead and he sent his son Rand Paul to Baylor, which is a Baptist university. And then Rand gets there, and the first thing he does is join this sort of secret society that makes it their business to make fun of and ridicule sort of the Baptist heritage of the school.
Right, and this is something that we
talk
about.
It's a typical youth rebellion. I mean, it might not, the religious aspects of it might not say all that much about where he is today. I think you brought up a really interesting point earlier, which is sort of like, in 1983, young men were supposed to have already learned a couple of lessons from the feminist movement. Maybe it's not a great idea to tie up a girl and try to force her to do drugs. But I don't know. I mean, maybe it was a bad judgment call, or maybe Baylor was sort of a bit behind the times when it came to those social movements and social issues.
Yeah, I'm personally not quite sure what to make of the feminist kind of take on this story. On one hand, it seems, you know, almost excruciatingly obviously true that tying up a girl and forcing her to do drugs is just a pretty uncool, reprehensible type activity. On the other hand, even the quotes from the woman in question, although she does say she didn't have contact with him afterward and that it was a, you know, it was a traumatic incident in some ways, the quotes are still kind of oddly low-key. And I think,
yeah,
you know, even
I had that thought too. It just, it wasn't really clear to what extent this may have been a kind of a joke that a whole group of friends were in on.
Right. Right. And I think,
or whether she was truly, truly terrified, you know.
Right. And it's almost, it's unclear from the GQ story. And I think the subsequent analysis has tended to be a bit of a Rorschach test. If you see this as a kind of failure of, you know, personal incorporation of the lessons of feminism by the 80s and a kind of personal failure by Rand Paul, then, you know, the word rape is suddenly in there somewhere, in like the blog post or in the article. And I think, there's no particular evidence that like she feared she was going to be raped or that this was anything of that caliber. On the other hand, it's hard to tell, and still being tied up and forced to do drugs just doesn't sound like my idea of an awesome, fun.
Yeah. And I mean, who wouldn't be scared of potentially being raped or something worse happened if some guy came to your door and, you know, tied you up and took you away from your home? I mean, I think in this case, she was friendly with these people and knew them. But, of course, we know that most rapists are know their victims socially.
Right. So and there is, of
I
course,
think,
the always
yeah, so
popular.
Yeah, so I totally agree that it's a Rorschach test. I guess the last thing I'd say about it is I think the story, and I think everything with the Paul kind of brings up this interesting question of the Paulite movement in 2008, I think, was a real precursor to the Tea Party that emerged during the health reform battle. In particular, the focus on the Constitution, the critique of social programs and social spending as unconstitutional. I think Ron Paul was really at the forefront of sort of introducing the public to those ideas when he ran for president in 2007, 2008. And now you see a sort of broader Republican coalition sort of inspired by the Tea Party embracing those ideas. And I think sort of underneath that, there's some real ideological disconnect between the more libertarian Pauls and the more traditionally conservative Republican base. And I still think we're watching how that is all going to play out.
I think you're absolutely right about that. And, I, you know, even in the face of the weirdness of the Paul clan, as someone who identifies as a libertarian, you know, I find this a little bit encouraging. You know, yes, there's these weird guys. Yes, they're suboptimal spokesmen in a lot of ways. And yet still, some of the stuff that they're saying is resonating. Now, I'm also deeply skeptical of the voting public in general. It's not clear to me that what the folks at the Tea Parties are hearing and saying back and voting on has anything to do with the deeper philosophy of limited government and, you know, limited state interference in the lives of individuals. I think it's just as likely that they're just kind of mad, and they're borrowing this language.
Since I've got you, and I don't speak to female libertarians all that often, I mean, what do you make of the Paulites and the Paul family's real embracing of pro-life, anti-abortion rights politics? Because I know that the libertarian movement is split on where it comes down on reproductive rights.
That's true. The libertarian movement is split as a demographic matter. A huge, huge, huge percentage of libertarians are pro-choice, sort of on the same argument that you would say for being against the death penalty, which most libertarians also are, that even if there is a moral issue at stake here, still to put the power of life and death in the hands of the state is a bad idea. And it's, you know, this also has to do with the draft. This is another big libertarian issue historically. That said, there are a subset of libertarians who just say, listen, the role of the state is to protect life and liberty, or life and liberty and property, and if you think it's a life, that's an appropriate role for the state. I don't buy that line, but it is sort of a respected historical position in libertarian movement. Again, for me, it's just frustrating that, you know, we finally get a national level spokesman who's at least semi-respectable, and he's this pro-life God guy who doesn't like immigrants, and he's that's
right.
What he wants to talk about. And, you know, mm-hmm. all of his votes against you know, pork and expansive welfare state and all this kind of stuff that that I would like to see him emphasize. He's just, you know, the fact of American politics is that we're always just going to be talking about God's guns and gays.
Well, I think that provides a perfect transition to the next topic we want to talk about, which I think has a lot to do with how the how social programs might or might not be able to deal with problems in people's lives and problems of poverty, which is this new study, and I'm just going to read off my notepad here. This new study in the journal Pediatrics that found that by age 7, 10% of white girls and 23% of African-American girls have started developing breasts. In part because of increased childhood obesity. 1 in 5 American children are obese, and fat cells can trigger estrogen production. And this is one of those things that sort of anecdotally people thought was true, that American girls were experiencing puberty earlier and earlier. But this new study really seems to confirm it. The number of girls experiencing this super early puberty has really shot up since the last comprehensive study in 1997. And it's a really big problem because girls who sexually develop earlier are at higher risk of breast cancer, other cancers, earlier sexual activity, depression, eating disorders, suicide. And in general, when parents see this in their children, they're super worried. A lot of mothers especially see that something's happening to their daughters that did not happen to them. And I think it raises a whole bunch of interesting questions. I mean, we know that the First Lady, Michelle Obama, has made childhood obesity a priority. And she's talking a lot about better school nutrition and more sort of opportunities to buy fresh produce in poor neighborhoods. But we know a lot of this is cultural. And so it's a really, really tough issue. And I think there's a lot to think about in terms of how the healthcare system might respond to this and also how the education system might respond to this. So any opening thoughts, Catherine?
Yeah, I mean, actually, this is, in some ways, not the central concept here. But one thing that strikes me is that this is really a reminder about how much obesity is a disease of the rich. And that's sort of, I think, a backward way from how we often see it, because here in the United States, in 2010, it's the people who are poorer in our society who tend to be fatter. But as a society, relative to all of human history, we're so rich that we have this incredible surplus of many things, including food. And one thing that the human body does is, you know, in response to fat times, to rich times, as opposed to lean times or starving times, it just does everything it can to get into reproductive mode. And so there is this phenomenon, which sort of seems scary to us in a lot of ways, that a 7-year-old would be undergoing puberty. That's, in sort of many societies for much of history, if you had a tribe whose 7-year-olds were suddenly growing breasts, there would be tremendous celebration because things are so good. We're so well.
I want to respond to a couple of points you're making really fast. Which is that it's definitely true that throughout history, the age of menarche or first menstruation has been going down as people become sort of better fed. And I think in terms of our biology and human history, you're making a really good point. But I think we have to be careful about associating obesity with wealth. Because while it's true that wealthier countries like the United States, Australia, and England have higher obesity rates, the people in those societies who tend to be obese are the poor people. And the reason why is because when you have less money to spend on nutrition, you're going to go spend it on these really high fat, sort of high calorie foods that leave you feeling satisfied, having spent less, like going to McDonald's instead of eating healthier. And we see this in the developing world too. When countries get their first McDonald's, for example, obesity can very quickly become a problem in developing countries. When there's an infusion of Western fast food.
Yeah, well, and I think you're absolutely right about that. There's, you know, it would be foolish to deny that pattern, but I think that, there is a one reason that this issue makes us nervous, and one reason that these kind of findings get a lot of attention is precisely because there's all of these additional kind of status anxiety things wrapped up in it, right? I mean, the 7-year-olds that are going through puberty are, I think, because of what the study says, we can guess, generally kids from poor neighborhoods, kids from poor families, and the idea that in addition to sort of skinny being a signifier of wealth and that, you know, eating healthy being a signifier of wealth, the idea that we would now have this sort of irreversible biological process possibly being a signifier of wealth is a little bit troubling. And, it certainly seems reasonable to be nervous about it.
And especially with problems like teen pregnancy among poor young women, I think it's a real problem that girls would be going through puberty at a younger age.
Right. And, you know, that said, I think I'm somewhat skeptical. I think this will kind of help us transition into the other point that you made. I'm somewhat skeptical that, school lunch, reforming school lunch programs is going to take much of a dent out of this problem. So I guess maybe I'm interested to hear from you, since I know this is something that you've written about and that you care about. What do you think, what do you think of kind of the Michelle Obama campaign, and do you think that that's something that can really take a dent out of this problem?
Mm-hmm. Well, to me, the Michelle Obama campaign just doesn't go far enough, in part because I don't think that people's behaviors are really going to change just by having fresh produce available or, say, just by changing what's given to kids at school at lunch, because I think in part how we eat is so cultural and it comes from our family and from our neighborhood. And if you're just talking about one meal a day at school, I don't think that's really going to change people's lives and their public health outcomes. That said, I think that a world in which children, especially children from low-income families, could have three meals a day at school and a much longer school day, I think that sort of really significant shift in how we see schools and their role in a community could really make an impact here. For example, if you knew your child was going to be getting breakfast at school, lunch at school, and, say, an early dinner at school, not only would that be so much better for parents who are tight on money, who are working really long hours, who aren't able to go provide educational or enrichment activities for their kids after school. I think if you sort of see the school as the locus of a social world for a child, and that would include the food that they eat, I think that could make a really big impact. And if you look at Western European countries where a full day of care is just the norm for children and parents aren't expected to arrange oh my gosh, I need to find a private caretaker for my kid at 3 o'clock, if government can kind of take on that responsibility, I think you can impact poor kids a lot more if you have more time in the day to spend with them.
I'm sympathetic to that in a lot of ways, but what is your response to, I think, the relatively undisputed point that right now public schools in this country suck, that they're really bad, and that sticking kids in them for longer may not be doing them a tremendous amount of favors? Mm-hmm. I think that's, that's a flip way of putting it, but that, at this point, I think that some of the really abysmal nutrition that happens in schools is in a lot of ways symptomatic of just an entire structure that's set up, to benefit adults and not kids, that it's all about Department of Ag surplus and teachers unions and a lot of other kind of adult concerns, and that kids are getting screwed by that. I assume that you're not saying let's take schools exactly as they are now and make them twice as long, but how do we get from here to there?
I think that's a really good question, and certainly true that things like the agriculture subsidies are really affecting in a negative way how children eat at school. That said, I think that there's a lot of examples of schools out there that have embraced the longer day and a sort of in loco parentis on steroids role in their students' lives, like the KIPP schools, that are showing how this can be done successfully. One of the critiques that the teachers' unions make of sort of the merit pay charter school driven model of school reform is that it's not looking at the whole child. And I think one of the things that teachers unions would really like to see is schools becoming the locus of all these various social services that would improve children's overall health, including nutrition. That said, teachers unions are going to have to be way more flexible for that to happen, because as soon as you start talking about a longer school day, you're asking a lot more of teachers, And as we know, the contracts are very strict in terms of how teachers are paid and how many hours they're expected to put in a day, in a week, in a year.
Yeah.
So I think that if we're going to have sort of an education reform agenda that both embraces the good things that the market-driven reformers are bringing to the table and that the experienced educators, the teachers, are bringing to the table.
Right.
The union.
It seemed to me like...
I think everyone needs to give a little bit and kind of expand the definition of where they're willing to move.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting because I think often in education discussions, there are sort of weird places of commonality where even people who think of themselves as being on very different parts of the political spectrum agree. You know, for instance, the disaster that is agriculture subsidies in this country is something that I think you and I could both agree needs reform. But I can't help but think when I hear you say, "Well, we'll need the teachers' unions to be flexible. We'll need the teachers' unions to give a little." That even in this time when we are completely out of money, the federal government is out of money, states are out of money, localities are out of money, and there's no end in sight. Teachers' unions are still pushing for raises, pushing for pension benefits, refusing merit pay agreements. And, D.C., as I'm sure you're aware, there's been a recent kind of interesting experiment going on in teacher evaluation and merit pay and, to be frank, firing a lot of teachers that I think it'll be interesting on the national level to see how that plays out. But certainly my sense being here in D.C. is that the teacher situation is such a crisis that stuff like school lunch is never going to get attention until that's resolved. That
yeah.
It's just, it feels very sad.
I think that we do have a lot of commonalities, I think. And I think education is a great issue around which to find commonalities across the political spectrum. I mean, the way I feel about teachers as workers is that they're middle-income workers, and I just am very supportive of their efforts to push for higher wages and more benefits. I mean, just across the country, middle-income workers are struggling, and teachers are no different, and traditionally it's been a profession that helps people be upwardly mobile, and it's a path to the middle class. And I think that it's a great thing that it has been a stable profession, and I think it's something that should be protected. Now, that's not to say that teachers' contracts shouldn't be modernizing and changing to embrace education reforms and innovations that have shown to be successful for children. I think there's a lot of skepticism among teachers because they don't necessarily feel that the people who are pushing them in that direction are always well-intentioned or that they very well understand what it's like to be a teacher. So I think that there's a lot of better communication that can happen. I think Washington, D.C. is obviously a super, super fascinating case study, in part because I think Michelle Rhee is doing a lot of things that parents would be very excited about, which is really telling teachers, but she set up this whole system that really tells teachers what they need to do to be considered successful,
right.
And then if they don't perform to those standards, they're being let go. I think people would like to be supportive of that, but she has taken a very aggressive, a very blunt sort of outlook toward the political situation in D.C., whether it's dealing with teachers, whether it's dealing with the city council. And I think the sort of lack of political finesse has been a big problem, and it's a big problem now for Mayor Fenty, where he's facing, he's facing a tough primary.
Yeah, and so I must say,
it's just a really complex issue.
I interviewed Michelle Rhee for a piece I did on this a while back, and I have to say that she, as I think she frequently does with interviewers who start out at all sympathetic, did win me over. I mean, she is just a ridiculously awesome gal in person, and I can see why the same thing that makes me like her, the same thing that makes me think, oh, she really speaks my language. And that actually is one funny thing about her. She talks like kind of a teenage girl or someone in their early 20s,
mm-hmm.
Which is a very
weird. I've also interviewed her several times. So.
And it's, I think that you, when you're talking to her, you both sort of want to like her because you feel like she's saying things that other people won't say. But, of course, there's a reason why other people don't say those things. It's because you wind up making life really hard for the mayor that's backing you or for the, dealing with the
Right. And when I interviewed her, you know, there was no small talk, no attempt to sort of build that warmth or rapport that you often find helps you as a journalist or even as any two people sort of sitting down for a meeting or a discussion. And I think that that's particular to who she is. You know, a part of me wanted to sort of be like, you go girl with her. She's a powerful woman of color in a position where she's really trying to make change. All that I respect. But I think schools are political. Schools and the communities around schools are political. And I think that a certain sort of finesse and a bit of respect for that process is really, really important.
Yeah, well, it's certainly, you know, whether or not you think it's a good thing for the dynamic, you're absolutely right that it's there. It's incredibly political. You know, I think that is one reason that while it's not yet anything like critical mass, there's a fair number of people that are looking for ways to just opt out of all of that political mess entirely. And that's kind of the rise of homeschooling, the rise of online education, and
right.
to some extent vouchers and charters are part of that same impulse to just step away, although I think it's turned out to be true that in general school reform, even vouchers and charters and that kind of thing, turn out to be, if anything, more political than the messy ingrained politics that they're trying to replace. So
And I guess just to sort of circle back to the issue of the lower age of puberty for girls, I mean, I think to me the big sort of incentive beyond getting school reform right and focusing on it as a legitimate political issue across the ideological spectrum is that when you look at sort of ways to circumvent bad inner city schools, whether it's vouchers, whether it's charters, you know, no matter how successful those experiments are, they've reached such a tiny, tiny percentage of the kids who need them. And when you see these numbers like this, like the 23% of African American girls who are going into puberty as early as age 7, that I think is kind of a wake-up call reminder that we need education reform that is broad-based enough to really reach and impact everyone who sort of needs and deserves a better school system and better social services in general.
At that point, the debate is just about whether, you know, in the end, you can do more good by reforming the existing system or undermining it. And that's probably a whole other kettle of fish, but maybe
we'll have to have a follow-up on that question.
Sure.
But I guess before we go, we've been asked by our overlords at Blogging Heads to discuss some summer reading.
That's right.
So I have
Which is nice because it's a segue from the education point. You know, reading is good.
Yeah,
reading
summer
is fundamental.
Reading. Do you remember when you used to get the reading list? And it was actually, I used to find it really fun to pick out my summer reading books.
Yep, absolutely. Although, you know, I did the summer before 12th grade, the mandatory reading for government class in my high school was Chris Matthews' Hardball.
Oh
worst
my God, I'm so
summer
sorry.
Reading ever. Okay, so.
Wow.
So tell me something better than Hardball to read this summer, Dana.
Yes. Well, one book which I'm actually showing the cover of is, I just finished this, it's Private Life by Jane Smiley. And this is historical fiction. And one of the reasons why it's really interesting is often when there's historical fiction, it focuses on people who are sort of exceptional for their time. And this is a book about a woman who's born in Missouri in the late 19th century. And it's about a woman who's just really typical for her time. And it focuses on how she's kind of forced into or pushed into an arranged marriage and how marriage is just sort of taught to her as sort of everything in her life, everything that she needs to aspire to, and sort of the crushing disappointment she goes through when she realizes that her marriage is not going to be a source for fulfillment in her life. And she goes through a lot of interesting moments in history, the big San Francisco earthquake, World War I, and there's just a lot of fascinating events that she lives through, but she's not sort of an actor or player in those events. She's more of a bystander, and to sort of see the dawning of the 20th century through the eyes of this woman who very much remains a sort of 19th century person and her struggle to sort of come to terms with the fact that she has missed out on a lot in life because she's been so focused on pleasing a husband who's not a horrible person. He doesn't beat her or anything, but he's just not a person who makes her happy. It's this It's a very moving book, and I really recommend it. It's Private Life by James Smiley. And then really quickly, there's two new books out that look back at the 2008 election, and they are both really entertaining reads, even though they are about politics. And I think it's kind of a good point as we head towards the midterms to sort of think back, especially for liberals, about all the hope and change and excitement that the 08 election stood for and sort of where we are now and why hopes have been dashed and why people have become so very cynical. And the first one, I have the review copy, but it's Big Girls Don't Cry by Rebecca Traister, who is, of course, a brilliant staff writer at Salon.com. And the book is sort of the first comprehensive look at gender in the 2008 elections, and it looks at both Hillary Clinton and Sarah Palin really deeply. And it's just a super smart book, and it's sort of avoids all the reductive sort of blame game around gender and race. And it just looks at what this contest meant between Hillary and Obama and then bringing Sarah Palin into it. It's very smart. And then the last book is Herding Donkeys, The Fight to Rebuild the Democratic Party and Reshape American Politics. It's by my friend Ari Berman, who's a staff writer at The Nation. And this is a book, it's sort of the on-the-ground organizing of the Obama campaign and sort of how they made it work. It's a very fascinating look at how campaigns work from the bottom up. And in particular, it's sort of a look back at how Howard Dean was really, really instrumental in changing the way Democratic elections are run and how he's often kind of shoved aside or not given the credit he deserves for sort of some of the transformations of the Democratic Party that led to Obama's election. So you know, those are three books I just read and really enjoyed.
I actually saw Howard Dean on MSNBC the other day, and he's hitting the Botox a little bit hard. Are there any revelations about that in the book?
And he what?
He's hitting the Botox a little bit hard, I think.
Oh,
his forehead
has
ceased to move. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, that's fascinating, but male Botox, that sounds like a subject for a book. You should write that.
I'll look into that. My recommendation is a plea to The Nation's Stieg Larsson fans. I read all three because, let's face it, they're just there and they have those nice neon covers and how can you say no? But just coincidentally, I picked up a book which actually I think was a recommendation of the excellent economist and blogger Tyler Cohen, who blogs at Marginal Revolution. And it's called Smilla's Sense of Snow. It's by Peter Hoag. And it's the same book, but written by someone with incredible talent, basically. The Stieg Larsson books are set in Sweden. This book is set in Denmark, but it's got the same manic pixie dream girl, goes on adventure to investigate murders, is implicated herself, strong silent guy of previously unrevealed credentials, love interest. It's really, you know, weirdly the same book, but like I say, written by someone who just has much more of a way with language. So for those who liked the Stieg Larsson books, I think you would really like Peter Hoag's Smilla's Sense of Snow.
Great. Yeah, I never read the Stieg Larsson books because I was just like flipping through them at the store and couldn't really see myself spending all that time.
Yeah, they're pretty fast junky reads, but like I say, you can skip them because you have the inside track to just read this other excellent book instead.
And that's great because I'm actually going away to California for 10 days on Saturday, so maybe I'll bring your book with me.
Well, and a book that's all about snow and ice is a good choice, at least in D.C. this week, so it'll cool you down.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Catherine. This was really fun. I hope it's just the first of many blogging heads for you.
Thank you very much to you as well.
Okay. Take care.
You too.